The National Endowment for the Arts, the NEA, has recognized two Wisconsinites for their artistry and cultural preservation, and we're meeting them both this hour. We have a pair of National Heritage Fellows on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The National Heritage Fellowship is a lifetime honor. It's the highest honor recognizing the folk and traditional arts heritage. We will start this by exploring Haudenosaunee-raised beadwork. It's also known as Iroquois-raised beadwork. Are you in a bead circle? What do you want to know about beadworking? It's 800-642-1234. Karen Ann Hoffman is an Iroquois-raised bead artist and citizen of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin. Karen Ann, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, good morning, and thank you so much for having me, Kate. I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, I am too. Help us first form a picture in our mind's eye what this raised beadwork looks like. Can you describe it to us?
Haudenosaunee raised beadwork is just exactly that. It's a hallmark of the Haudenosaunee culture. It is made of beads, which are small glass seed beads, and it is raised. It is embossed. The distinction about our style of beadwork is that our work stands proud, high, embossed. It is raised over the substrate. And so when you see that dimensionality, you know you're looking at work that comes from Haudenosaunee culture.
And where do these beads come from? What are they made of?
Well, I particularly use Czechoslovakian glass beads. There are many, many beads on the market, but the Czechs, the Bohemians, the Venetians have been making amazing glass for centuries. And so I stick with Czechoslovakian beads. They're always glass. I was always told, Kate, use the best quality materials you can find in your artwork, because your artwork stands not for you, but for all of us, all of the Haudenosaunee. And so to invest in quality materials is investing in our culture.
You know, just some clarification and distinction here. The Oneida Nation is one of the six nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, and which is also known as the Iroquois Confederacy by the French. Is that right?
Yeah, that is right. So a quick little history lesson. The Haudenosaunee, our homeland, is in the eastern Great Lakes. If you think of the area that starts, oh, roughly around Lake Erie, and you take yourself east to the Hudson River, and you go north and south of that imaginary line that they draw between the United States and Canada, that's Haudenosaunee home territory. If you think about the Niagara Falls, you're kind of in the middle of it.
Okay.
So in the 1820s, as things were changing on the American landscape, one of the big changes was the construction of the Erie Canal. One of the difficulties with constructing the Erie Canal was it was the homeland of the Oneida people, of the Oneota'ka. And so because of a slight land issue, there was a removal of the Oneota'ka from that area. Now, some folks did stay, and there are still Oneida in New York. But many went to Canada, many went to Kansas, and many of us were relocated here to Wisconsin. At that time, Kate, what happened was the state of Wisconsin was not even yet a state. It was simply a territory. And so the federal government was in charge, and the federal government said to the original peoples of this area, the Omatnomenewak, the Menominee, they asked those Menominees if they wouldn't mind making room for the New York Indians. And so the Oneida Reserve comes to be carved out of the dwindling land base that the Menominees had during that period. So because of the construction of the Erie Canal, we move from our homeland in the eastern Great Lakes here into the welcoming arms of Wisconsin, and we have made our home here since the 1820s, about 100 years now.
Explain how the beadwork emerges in the history.
Native art has been present on this Turtle Island for a very long time. You can find rock art that stretches back I don't know, 10, 12, 14,000 years. So we as human beings have been expressing ourselves through art for as long as we have been human beings. The materials that we use for that cultural expression do change over time, Kate. So what once might have been scratched into a rock, painted onto a stone, etched into a shell, over time, as new materials become available, those cultural expressions become expressed with new materials. Now, beads have been on the continent of Turtle Island for, you know, archaeologists will argue about this, but there have been bone beads in existence for multiple thousands of years. And so that has been a part of our decorative history for at least that long. Mm. The infusion of glass trade beads in the late 1500s absolutely made a catalyst for new ways of expressing very old ideas.
I'm going to reintroduce you here. Karen Ann Hoffman is an Iroquois-raised bead artist, member of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin, and she is a National Heritage Fellow. We're talking about her work, the meaning of it, and how she does it. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Cindy is joining us from Appleton. Hi, Cindy.
Hello. Now, I'm just wondering what you use, because you talked about just, you know, glass beads and how you use really good glass beads. But what did you use, you know, back decades and maybe even a century ago? What did they use for beadwork?
So, Cindy, that's an excellent question. And I appreciate you listening in. That's so awesome to me. Beads have been in our hands, in Haudenosaunee hands, since the early 1500s, glass beads. In fact, there are records that show that glass beads were in our territory before the first settler came. There are some amazing ancient trade routes that exist all across Turtle Island. So those glass beads came to us really quickly. But what you want to know is what we used before that. And the answer, Cindy, is shell, boned beads, clay beads, and other decorative artifacts, perhaps moose hair tufting, paint, clay, incisions into wet clay, all kinds of materials were available.
So fast forward to the 1990s, you discover an Iroquois beadwork workshop. What do you remember from that first experience?
So, you know, I grew up and I was a young woman in the 1970s, and I did kind of the pan-Indian beadwork that a lot of women like me did, young girls. And, you know, I made a pair of earrings and I made a little bracelet. And, of course, I had a good man, my Michan, my Mike, and I beaded up a hat for him. And it was really just a very casual thing. But there came an advertisement in our Oneida Nation newspaper, the Galloway-Sioux, and it said, Samuel Thomas and his mother, Lorna Hill, are coming from Niagara Falls, Ontario, to do a workshop in raised beadwork. I had little or no interest, but my husband encouraged me to go. So I went, and Kate, I fell in love. I fell in love with the beadwork. I fell in love with the responsibilities. I fell in love with Lorna Hill and her son, Samuel Thomas. I fell in love with that community of beaders that I was welcomed into. And I have been a part of that family ever since. It was an amazing mistake.
Oh, I love that. Karen Ann Hoffman is one of the traditional artists from around the country selected for the National Heritage Fellowship. It's a lifetime honor by the NEA. Karen Ann, known for her Iroquois beadwork. These are beads that raised and arched above the fabric surface to create this multidimensional effect. Have you seen raised beadwork before at a museum, maybe? What fascinates you about it? What do you want to know about preserving this art form? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Karen Ann Hoffman here on the Ideas Network. Mm-hmm. you're with us for the morning show as we learn about Indigenous beadwork, specifically Iroquois raised beadwork. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The beadwork is intricate, it's time-consuming, each piece communicating a story and helping to keep the culture alive. Karen Ann Hoffman of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin is a National Heritage Fellow recognized for her artistry. Have you tried your hand at beadwork? What is it like? What do you want to know about her work and the Iroquois tradition? Join in at 800-642-1234. Karen Ann Hoffman is with us for about 10 more minutes. Karen Ann, I want to ask you a bit of a technical question, I suppose. How, you know, in terms of the textile and the fabric that these beads are on, it seems it's often velvet. What choices do you have in terms of the fabric to put these beads on?
You know, you're right, Kate. It is quite common to see this work done on velvet. You can also find it done on trade cloth, on wool fabrics. But, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about using the best materials available to express these ideas. And velvet surely does rank up there as a luxurious material. So when I can get a hold of it, I absolutely do use velvet. The other piece that's quite common is to have the work lined with calico. And so, you know, Kate, sometimes we talk about it like this. Calico is a fabric that was introduced to the Haudenosaunee by the Dutch. It was a gift to cement one of the first treaties ever written between the Haudenosaunee and the Dutch. And so when we do our beadwork on the top of a piece of art, we are expressing our way of living. When we line that beadwork with that gift from our neighbors, we're using that as a visual representation that two cultures can live side by side, neither interfering with the other, but both supporting the other, living together and existing in a way that makes the other stronger, better, and happier.
I think what you're saying is, you know, that your artistry is informing this dialogue we're having today around the injustices our country must confront, specifically this long history of exploitation and appropriation of Indigenous culture.
I think that that's true. And one of the things that separates my beadwork from the work of many other fine artists is that while I am deeply concerned that my work is culturally connected in a very rich way, I also exist in these contemporary times. And the work that I do responds to what I see happening or being reflected upon in these contemporary times.
What are you working on now?
Right now, Kate, I'm working on a piece that's been put into my hands by some ancestors back in the 1860s. So yeah, there were some difficult times. And in the 1840s, 50s, and 60s, Wisconsin was a turbulent place that was changing, changing, changing. There were many, many settlers that were coming into Wisconsin. That movement displaced some of the original Indigenous peoples from their homelands. And so people were mixed. People were moving. There was much turmoil. Fast forward to the 1860s into the town that I live in, Stevens Point, Wisconsin, and you'll see that there is settlement by the settlers up close to the river. And there is this group of mixed natives, some Potawatomi, some Ho-Chunk, some Menominees, living where the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point campus is right now. Scarlet fever breaks out in the white community of Stevens Point and somehow gets transferred into this refugee camp. Well, people died. In that refugee camp, the numbers are uncertain, but 30, 50, 70, maybe 100 natives died. Those people were buried by their families on the outskirts of that refugee camp. Because of the way things were, those refugees could not stay on that piece of property for a very long time. And so they move on, but they're dead. Their dead remain behind. And so as Stevens Point begins to grow in the 1870s and 80s, that old encampment, that burial ground, becomes two things. It becomes a quarry and it becomes a garbage dump. Mm. So we have on that campus native bodies, historic garbage. And by the 1890s, the construction of a Stevens Point Normal School, which becomes the University of Wisconsin at Stevens Point. Those ancestors speak to me as a human being. I'm a graduate of that school at least twice. I'm a resident of Stevens Point, Wisconsin, and I am in many ways connected to those dead. So I am now working on a piece of beadwork that I hope will bring some comfort, some acknowledgement, some rest and recognition to those ancestors who for too long have been walked over on a daily basis by folks who just plain didn't realize they were there. So I'm trying as an individual to raise awareness that there are these people buried beneath. And this is not an isolated incident. Things were tumultuous in Wisconsin in the last quarter of the 1800s. And I think as human beings, we do well to look at the mistakes that we make and learn from them. So that as we move forward into this new pandemic, we don't make the mistakes that we made back in the 1860s, that we learn and move forward. And like the calico and the velvet, live together side by side as communities who support one another, encourage one another, and make each other happier, healthier, and stronger. So that, Kate, what I'm working on.
Thank you for sharing that story. As we talk with Karen Ann Hoffman, an Iroquois raised bead artist, member of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin, a National Heritage Fellow, and taking your questions, your insights, 800-642-1234. Gary is joining us from Ripon with a question. Hi, Gary.
Hi, I just had a question. Does the guest have any feelings about devoting so much of life to something that's not progress?
What do you mean by that?
Well, she's not doing it on a computer, and she's not making a stealth bomber. She's not coming up with some new grand and glorious.
Okay, all right, Gary. I'm sorry, Karen Ann,
That's okay. Let me just take this and say that, you know, it's totally okay for people to have different opinions, and that's fine. That's why we all live in this world together. But I would say that I do take great strength from doing things that are deeply connected to my history and to our shared history. I think it's super important to know that we live in three time zones at the same time. The past informs the present, which lays the table for the future. And I like for my artwork to be fully representative of all those three spots in time in one piece.
Your work, The Wampum Urn, is part of the permanent collection at the Smithsonian's Institution, National Museum of the American Indian. Can you describe this urn?
So it's a three-sided urn. It's made of purple velvet. It's decorated with clear glass beads. It's also decorated with wampum, which are shells that come from the East Coast. They're beautiful clam shells. They're white and they're purple and they swirl together. Wampum is a really important symbol for we people of the Eastern Woodlands. It is a sign of commitment. It's used to write promises with. It is a thing of high value. So I was very tickled when the National Museum, the Smithsonian Institution, acquired that piece and gave him a home. I'm really excited to say that Wampum Urn is now on exhibit at Epcot Center.
Oh, wow.
As of Disney's new Native American exhibit at the Epcot Center. We'll be there for about 5 years. And, you know, Keith, I always say artwork is not fully alive until it's engaged in conversation with an audience. And I am so excited that tens of thousands of pairs of eyes will have a chance to engage with Wampamern and some of the other amazing Native art down at Epcot Center.
It seems like you find that there is a place for these pieces in museums today.
I believe that there is a place for, I call these major pieces my legacy pieces. And I do believe that when I spend a year or two or more really working on a piece, that they are imbued with some kind of animacy. And so I do look for institutions who respect that idea. Mm. And I'm happy to say that there are many of them in our areas.
Karen Ann, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Thanks to Wisconsin. And thank you to the NEA for supporting traditional art. So important.
Karen Ann Hoffman, Iroquois-raised beat artist in Stevens Point. Coming up, we talk with another Wisconsin artist being honored by the National Endowment for the Arts for his birch bark canoes. What questions do you have about the construction, the traditions of birch bark canoes? 800-642-1234. News update is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now we're taking a look at the Foxconn, and Corrine Hess has more on the changes that have occurred.
Last week, Foxconn executives announced plans to begin manufacturing electric vehicles for a California-based startup. In a joint statement, the companies boasted the collaboration will revolutionize the automotive industry, comparing themselves to Isaac Newton. It wasn't the first time Foxconn has announced an attention-grabbing partnership. In 2019, the company was going to make automated coffee kiosks. In 2020, it was ventilators. But both projects ended soon after being announced. Assembly Minority Leader Gordon Hintz is a longtime critic of Foxconn.
Everything that they've promised so far, none of it has been true, and none of it has played out.
In 2017, Foxconn claimed it would create 13,000 jobs in the state. Hintz says Wisconsin operations have appeared to be virtually non-existent.
From the beginning, the lack of transparency, the lack of honesty, and the lack of accountability from Foxconn really plagued their overall project and investment.
Since Foxconn became a known entity in Wisconsin, the company has made promises across the state. For some people, Foxconn's arrival 3 years ago brought hope for more than just a massive manufacturing campus in southeastern Wisconsin. The worldwide company's arrival here brought a dream for new technologies and new educational opportunities. In 2019, Foxconn announced it would locate its North American headquarters in downtown Milwaukee. The company promised 500 research and development employees in the city. Milwaukee's Common Council member, Robert Bauman, whose district includes downtown Milwaukee, says he hasn't heard from Foxconn since the announcement. He says he was skeptical from the beginning.
But, these were the claims they were making, so they obviously were a huge employer, very large worldwide company. Maybe they knew something we didn't. Well, it turns out they didn't.
After the Milwaukee announcement, Foxconn made plans to open what the company called innovation centers in Racine, Eau Claire, Green Bay, and Madison. These would have been hubs where engineers could work and develop new technology. Foxconn bought buildings, but the workers never came. Kevin Vonk was a development director until August in Green Bay. He worked closely with Foxconn and says for a while it seemed real.
The meetings became fewer and far between. They had some staff turnover, and Green Bay just did not seem that was their top priority.
Foxconn didn't respond to requests for comment on the innovation centers or other questions. Technology and education seemed to be a top priority for the company. In August 2018, Foxconn announced plans to invest $100 million at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. University spokesman John Lucas says the company donated a total of $700,000, less than 1% of what it pledged. It went to research projects at the College of Engineering. Lucas says the university will continue to reach out to companies, including Foxconn, to see if they're interested in additional partnerships. In a statement to WPR, Foxconn representatives say market conditions have changed over the last 3 years. They say they're working with the state on a plan that will benefit Wisconsin taxpayers and give them flexibility. Last October, Racine County Supervisor Jody Spencer joined other elected officials on a tour of Foxconn's Mount Pleasant facility given by the company.
It was a massive building with, I would say, few people working. I guess, to be honest, I didn't know what was real and what was framed up for the touring.
When Foxconn was first announced, Spencer was a mail carrier in Racine. And like a lot of other people, she was doubtful that the company could live up to its promises. She says the tour didn't change her mind. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And now we're exploring birch bark canoes here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. These canoes are a key part of traditional Ojibwe life. Ojibwe artists have worked to maintain and transfer knowledge of the canoe-building tradition within their communities. And the birch bark canoe, it was a very versatile, used in transportation, fishing, harvesting wild rice, and hunting. What do you want to know about the craftsmanship in these canoes and the rich meaning behind the symbols? Join in at 800-642-1234. Wayne Valier is an Ojibwe birch bark canoe builder and an Ojibwe language teacher. He's a member of the Lac des Flambeaux Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians and a National Endowment for the Arts Heritage Fellow. Wayne, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Yes, thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, this is remarkable canoe technology, extremely lightweight. Can you describe first for us what a birch bark canoe looks like before we go into the engineering?
Well, it looks like it's the same shape as a canoe, a modern metal canoe. It's just it's made with the outer hull is birch bark off a white birch tree, and the interior is all carved cedar planking.
When
pulled together with spruce root.
And it could be as light as 58 pounds.
Yes, it's depending on Anishinaabe, we made a lot of different types of canoes depending on what we were going to do with the canoe. If we were going to harvest wild rice or it was a canoe that we needed to travel with to another seasonal area, those canoes would be larger canoes for more cargo. So they made canoes to fit their different needs and the hunting, gathering society.
How did you know that this was your calling to build these canoes?
Well, one of the reasons why I started building again is because not too long ago, it got down to the point where there was only five Ojibwe canoe builders left in the Midwest. And it was something that was as common as everybody driving a car today. That was our main method of travel. So the knowledge went from pretty much every family knew it, could build their own canoe. It went from that down to five builders in these modern times. It is the apex of our cultural crafts, and it would have been a great shame to lose that part of our identity as Anishinaabe people. So I started the process of building them again and showing other people how to build them so that canoe culture will rise again and be alive and well in Anishinaabe country.
I imagine only Mother Nature maybe to answer this question, but how long might it take you to find just the right birch tree for a canoe?
Well, it's becoming more difficult all the time. I've seen a lot of change in my life, especially with the forest, because of deforestation and a lot of other things that have plagued our forests. Birch trees, especially quality birch bark, is becoming harder and harder to find. So we'll go out and we'll test several trees in an area. First of all, the tree has to be, in my liking, at least 15 to 18 inches in diameter, and the bark has to be over an eighth inch thick. It has to pass all these tests in order to be canoe quality bark. So finding that type of tree, we'll test sometimes 20, 30 trees before we find a canoe quality piece of bark. So it's a lot of walking. It's going to a lot of birch forests and our federal, state, and tribal lands. So it's getting more difficult all the time.
I learned about the heritage, the tradition of sinking the canoes in the winter and then wading out to get them in the spring. Can you explain why that was done?
Yeah, so, you know, there again, it was Anishinaabe used their birch bark canoe pretty much all year long, but except the winter time. So in late fall, a month we call Gushkidinogizis, which means the freezing moon, which is November, when the ice first freezes. So at that time, Anishinaabe would take their birch bark canoes and they would wade out about chest high in the water and sink their canoes in the cold water. They would weigh them down with stones, and some people would even go as far as lining the bottoms of them with clay before they sunk them. But they sunk them in that cold water and left them over the winter under the ice so that when the ice receded in the spring, when the ice went out far enough to get your canoe, then it was time to pull it out, because it was time to harvest the fish.
Mm.
You're a torchlight from your canoe. So the season started all over again, the industrial year, the Anishinaabe.
Wow. What are the symbols that you carve into these canoes? What do they mean?
Well, it depends. You know, every canoe depends on the people that are around it, certain happenings, certain signs we get from nature. Different things all contribute to the type of patterns and the decorative part that we do in our canoes. But they're always honoring creation, and we're always honoring and respecting all living things in our designs.
Once you do find the right birch tree, what happens after that?
Well, after we find the right birch tree, then it's a matter of waiting on nature's time until that birch tree is ready to give you her bark. So it's usually in June of the year when the bark loosens on the white birch tree. So we'll take a ladder and we'll put it up on a birch tree, and we'll go up 25 feet up that tree, and we'll make one single cut from the top all the way down straight line, and then we peel it with a circular disc made of birch bark. We call a bark disc, and that circle is rolled underneath the layer, and the bark pops and cracks right off the tree. We then clamp it with some long saplings so that the bark won't split. And then it's taken off the tree with a couple of people, one on the top of the ladder, who, when it comes off, he walks down with the top of the huge sheet of bark.
Well, oh, my
goodness. The bottom walks away from the tree.
Wow.
Taken off.
Wow. So very labor intensive, done by hand. And then what happens when you have this sheet of bark?
Well, when we have, what happens after we get the sheet of bark?
Uh-huh.
Well, before everything happens, we have a ceremony begging the tree of a thousand pardons for what we're about to take, and letting the tree know that we're going to make a canoe out of this bark and we appreciate it. Mm-hmm. And we're doing something with the bark that was given to us a long time ago. So we're following our tribal ways in that way. So after the bark is taken off, it's rolled up into a cylinder and tied, and it's carried out. And it's kept in a cool, damp place until the building is going to happen.
Let's pause there with Wayne Valier, who is an Ojibwe birch bark canoe builder who has been learning the crafts of his ancestors since he was a teenager. Have you built a canoe? What can you tell us about the process? What did you learn? And what do you want to ask Wayne about Anishinaabe life and building traditional birch bark canoes? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with birch bark canoe maker Wayne Valier. He's one of the great educators and protectors of cultural practice in his Lac des Flambeaux Band of Lake Superior Chippewa and recipient of a lifetime honor from the National Endowment for the Arts. He's with us for 10 more minutes. Let's take a question now from Peter in Viroqua. Hi, Peter. What would you like to ask?
Hi. Yeah. Thank you, Wayne, for coming on. And this is amazing knowledge that you've been helping to preserve. I was wondering if you've ever made a canoe where you've used smaller pieces of birch bark and figured out a way to sew them all together to make the one large piece. And then the other thing, does the tree still live after you take the bark off it? Thank you.
Thank you for that question. As a matter of fact, the answer to your second question is the tree heals after the bark is taken off. The birch bark has a couple of different layers. There's the outer rind, and there's the inner rind that's next to the wood called the Precambrian layer. So the tree is carefully slit until there's a popping sound where it lifts off that Precambrian layer. Once it's taken off, we've harvested trees a second time after about 12 to 13 years. The bark comes back on some of the trees, and it doesn't kill the trees.
Wow. Have you ever used smaller pieces and stitched them together?
Yes. That's the other good question is from the research that I've done. Back in 1900, when there was a lot of logging happening in northern Wisconsin, and it's obvious the birch trees were taken right down with the timber. So what happened was our different methods of building with flared stakes that were flared out at angles in the building process, they used a smaller sheet of bark underneath the canoe, and they pieced it together with several pieces that are sewn together. And we use a certain stitch called a harness stitch that really locks the bark together, so we can sew several pieces together. As a matter of fact, some of the tribes to the north, the Creeks, I believe, their birches are quite small in their territory, but it doesn't stop them from building Wigwasajimon. They harvest that bark and they sew it together in pieces. And as long as you seal it, you can sew it.
It seems like this is a sustainable process then.
Yes, it's totally sustainable. Everything that we harvest does not damage the tree. The roots that we take from the spruce trees that we use for all the sewing, only the secondary roots are taken from the spruce and they grow back. It doesn't damage the tree at all. The bark, I just said that it grows back. And the Anishinaabe, they used dead standing cedar to split, because once the bark is off the cedar, you can see the grains of the wood, and it can split, and you can split it much straighter and longer for gunwale stock and such. So all the materials, and then the pitch, for example, that's used for the sealant, that's expressed from the tree, and it's taken off, and it just expresses more. So it's all sustainable.
Let's bring in Susan in Milwaukee with a question. Hi, Susan.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for this beautiful, beautiful show. I was lucky enough to attend UWM, and I took classes with John Boatman and learned a lot about Native American philosophy. Anyway, I just want to ask your newmaker if he's ever made McCook, because when I took classes, we had to make these small boxes that you can actually set on a flame and they will not burn. Yeah. Has he ever made those? I really enjoyed the classes and I'm really enjoying the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Right. So, it is true that once you can boil water in a birch bark container, once the water is in the container, and you can actually, the flame will not start the birch bark on fire. You can actually boil water in a birch bark container. If the heat source is held far enough away from it, it won't burn.
Wow. That is really incredible and so versatile to do so many things with birch bark.
Yes, it's a very sacred tree to the Anishinaabe. All the trees are sacred. They all have a purpose and a reason for being here. But the birch tree was given to the Anishinaabe a long time ago by our great cultural hero, the master of life. His name was Winnebujou, the great rabbit. He was our uncle that made this island that the Anishinaabe live on. But anyway, he gifted us with this birch tree, and he told us that this birch tree would forever be a protector, and it would be of great use to the Anishinaabe. And through the times, the Anishinaabe have used birch bark from the cradleboard all the way to the grave. We make our homes from it, called wigwams. We make our tikanagan, our receptacles, where we put our babies in. And also, at the end of our term, we send birch bark with our loved ones in their great journey into the great shining town. So, and it's used, birch bark was used to scratch pictographs to keep our history on, for our history going back thousands of years.
Wow.
Birch bark is used as decorative for jewelry. It's also used as a medicine. It can be put through a process scientists call dry distillation, and glue could be extracted from birch bark. So there's many, many different uses, and it was promised in the beginning that birch bark would be of great use to the Anishinaabe, and it was. It's our containers to keep our food in, to cooking our food, to storing our food, our receptacles for our babies, like I said, and our history, and our canoes, and our torches. We burn birch at night for light. So it's got many uses, and it's also a medicine.
Wayne, thank you so much for joining us and sharing this craft with us, this heritage. Wayne Valier is a birch bark canoe builder and member of the Lac des Flambeaux Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. Earlier, we talked with Iroquois-raised bead worker Karen Ann Hoffman of the Oneida Nation. You can find a link to the NEA Heritage Fellowship at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.